Long before Me Too or Time's Up and the fall of mighty men like Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer was Anita Hill. It was 1991, and Hill testified before a Senate Judiciary Committee that her former boss, Clarence Thomas, then nominated to be Justice of the Supreme Court, had persistently and aggressively harassed her. And here we should warn you that today we will be talking about sexual harassment and assault in terms that may not be suitable for all ears.
He did continually pressure me to go out with him, continually. He talked about pornographic materials on several occasions.
Millions watched the hearings on national television. Thomas was named to the court, and Anita Hill's story became a cautionary tale for what happens when you choose to go on the record. 25 years later, and 15 months before the Weinstein story broke, U.S. Representative Anne McLean Custer from New Hampshire openly revealed in Congress that she had been sexually assaulted 3 times.
I tell these stories tonight on the floor of the United States Congress, not because they are remarkable or unique. Sadly, I tell these stories because they are all too common.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and today on Word of Mouth, Me Too. Right here, right now. We're going to hear from a variety of New Hampshire women and explore the effects of trauma and healing. And we'll check in with public conversations about consent and prevention that have been opened up by a hashtag. We are hearing from women today. It was a woman who invited other women to use the Me Too hashtag originally, but we know that people who identify in other ways have also experienced sexual harassment and violence. First up, we're going to hear more from Anne McLean Custer, Congresswoman from New Hampshire's 2nd District. Here's a compressed version of the stories that she shared.
40 years ago. On a cold winter night at a prestigious college, assaulted me in a crude and insulting way by a distinguished guest of the United States Congress. I was 23 years old. I was grabbed in the dark, and I fought free. I ran again, alone, into the cold, dark night. Until I wrote these words to share with you tonight, I had never told anyone this story. My family didn't know, my husband, my children, my friends.
Custer's account led to the formation of a bipartisan task force to end sexual violence. And she was a co-sponsor of the so-called Me Too bill, reforming the claims process against members of Congress. The bill passed with overwhelming bipartisan support last month. I asked Annie Custer why, after so many years, she decided to break her silence back in the summer of 2016.
When this story of Emily Doe first came into the news, and then the story of Chessie Prout at St. Paul's School right here in Concord, and how courageous she was on the Today Show, and how straightforward she was talking about it, I began to realize that the silence of my generation was making us complicit in the environment of rampant sexual harassment, sexual assault in our society. I became woke, if you will.
I'm trying to imagine you on that day telling these 3 very personal stories. What was happening for you as you're suiting up and getting ready to tell that story?
That's funny, suiting up, because that's exactly what it was. Well, we read the Emily Doe statement, and that was an amazing experience that was men and women, gay and straight, black and white, Republican and Democrat. It was quite an extraordinary experience. And afterward, a group of us were talking, and I said, this happened to me, not this exact experience, but being sexually assaulted at a fraternity party on a college campus had happened to me. We all started talking, and I realized that my colleagues had similar stories. And over the course of the next couple of weeks, talked about telling those stories on the floor of the House. The evening came where we were going to do that, and it turned out I was the only one that did. The others were supportive of me. And so there was a moment where I felt like I'd gone too far.
How did you not cry?
I came close. You can probably see it on YouTube. I came close. I think at this point, I understand from the young women I've met how powerful this concept of shattering the silence is. I can remember very clearly when I first was going to tell the story, I was speaking to a friend of mine who is a social worker therapist. And I said, well, what happened to me is not as bad as what happened to Emily Doe. And she said, Annie, you don't have to be left for dead behind a dumpster to be taken seriously. What happened to you should not have happened.
This was months before the revelations or the news broke of Harvey Weinstein's raping, coercing, silencing women, and the cascade of revelations that came since then. So what was the response?
I can say that both of men and women colleagues were very supportive of me, and they have been from the beginning. And I think we all feel very, very strongly that we need to come together and to eliminate sexual harassment in the workplace, in our society, on the U.S. Capitol, and to make sure that we do everything we can to address sexual assault. I've created a bipartisan task force to end sexual violence in the United States Congress and across the country. We have 40 members of Congress, Republican and Democrats, working together, and that will grow. I'll give you one very concrete example that our task force is working on. We had a hearing with the actress Mariska Hargitay about the backlog of rape kits. And there are tens of thousands of rape kits across the country that had never been processed as evidence. What other crime would we not process the evidence? And it turned out we learned that it was because police had thought that the DNA evidence was only needed to identify the perpetrator. And if they had a known perpetrator, a boyfriend, a spouse, a family member, they didn't process the rape kit. Well, what they found when they did go back, a couple of different cities did it, they'd processed 10,000 rape kits in a backlog, they'd find over 800 repeat serial predator rapists in the data, in the DNA. And the point being that the kind of people that harass, harass repeatedly. It has an exponential effect if they're not stopped at the first comment or touch. It gets worse. And the same is true with regard to violent crime, with regard to sexual assault.
One of the things that's come across to me in my research about this is how many women like you stayed silent, didn't tell anybody. But also there's this perception that powerful women cede something. They're giving away a part of their power when they acknowledge, I was a victim. So I'm wondering what that felt like for you.
Well, certainly there's a certain amount of risk. But what I've learned from Emily Doe, from Chessie Prout, from survivors that I've met, is that the emphasis is on the survivor. You take your power back. And it's very ironic. I feel better. I feel stronger. I feel more secure. I feel safer. One of the journalists had asked me, did I have any long-term consequences? And I started to say, oh, no, I'm fine. And then I said, well, I don't like to be alone at night. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I wake up in the night screaming. And that was more to do with the person that assaulted me and dragged me into an alley. But women are strong. We're resilient. We fight on, we carry on for another day. Certainly, this has been a focus for me raising two sons. We can do better. We can raise compassionate people.
How do you go from Me Too, you know, people hashtagging this, putting it out on social media? Where do you go to from there?
I have so many ideas for this, but what I really want to say is that everyone can play a role. So if a friend comes to you, if a family member comes to you, you can take a stand. You can speak up. It's just like the signs in the airport. If you see something, say something. where we started our work was with the colleges here in New Hampshire and now nationally on college sexual assault. And then since then, I've been convinced that we need to start younger and younger. And so part of our task force is working on K-12 education and prevention. And I think what we're recognizing in this Me Too moment and this movement is how big this is in our society. Every single age group. I had a colleague come up to me on the floor and he said, "Garrison Keillor, when is this going to stop?" And I just looked at him and I said, "You know what? This has been a long time in coming. Decades of silence. So you're going to have to settle in. It's going to be a little uncomfortable. It shouldn't have happened to me, but it absolutely should not be happening 40 years later."
Annie Custer, United States Congresswoman from New Hampshire's 2nd District. We posted a link to her telling her story on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives at wordofmouthradio.org. And Chessie Prue, one of those young women who inspired her, she's coming out with a memoir called I Have a Right To next week. She'll be reading from it and talking about it at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord on Sunday, March 18th. Information at wordofmouthradio.org. Throughout this episode, you'll be hearing from New Hampshire women who, like Congresswoman Custer, have broken their silence. These are the voices of those who responded to our request to share their experiences of and perspectives on sexual assault and harassment. They will be identified by first name only. This is Elaine.
So my first experience was in the Piscataquag River in Goffstown. And four teenage boys, slightly older than myself, attacked me in the river. And it was a deep river, and we were over our heads. And it was embarrassing. I was 14, I think, at that time, and very naive and innocent. But I didn't want to make a fuss and just felt it was better to leave it. I regret in some ways that I didn't tell anybody, but what could I have done, and how could I have been in a court of law? How could I have said, yes, that's the guy? I didn't tell my parents because I knew my father would absolutely go ballistic. Just take this to a level that would be quite dreadful. Small town, everybody knows everybody. I was embarrassed, of course. It's just, you can kind of see ahead how things might go if you speak up. And I just didn't. I never really told anybody, except you. Well, I told my husband, but we've been married 48 years. I don't think he remembers any of those conversations.
After the break, personal stories of healing and growing stronger after experiencing sexual assault or harassment. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before we continue, a note that on today's show, we're talking about sexual harassment and assault in terms that may not be suitable for all ears. So for younger listeners or people who are especially sensitive to the topic, we want to let you know that. We ask listeners who use the MeToo hashtag if they're willing to talk about their experiences. Among those we heard from was a woman who, years after the fact, found the words to talk about her trauma and begin to heal. This is Faye.
The analogy that I have is that it was like I was walking through water, and every year the water got thicker until it was almost like cement, and I was barely able to think, to function, to do, to accomplish, to feel good about myself. I thought there was something I thought like I was defective in some way, and that I just wasn't getting it about how to live life. Because it just kept getting more difficult, and I kept seeing other people, like, being able to, like, have friends and get married, have kids, you know, do what they do the things they wanted to do. And even though I was doing some of those, it didn't feel like it was an accomplishment. It just felt like things just kept getting harder and more difficult. I knew exactly what he did, okay? I could describe the actions, but I did not have that word, that idea. I was sexually assaulted. And that is an act of violence. That is not an act of a father loving a daughter. I got into therapy and I started talking about it. And it felt so good to be able to say, just to say what it was like and what had happened. Because before I was able to do that, I didn't know what was wrong. To be able to see myself, parts of me, as being healthy. That I could take those healthy parts of me and I could bring them in to the part of me that was so injured and so damaged and so hurt. So my therapist could be helpful to me, but I could also be helpful to myself. In my professional life, I never spoke about what happened to me because I worked in small communities and I felt like it was not something that I wanted to share with everybody. And I had, you know, as a therapist or as a nurse, I had, like, some visibility. So I am thrilled to feel like I'm retired and I can speak all I want now. And nobody can touch me. Nobody can criticize me. Nobody can shame me. Nobody can do anything. I can say anything I want about my experiences. And I am so thrilled to have been asked.
Among the things surfaced by the Me Too movement is how isolating and complicated the experience of sexual harassment and assault can be. Compounding that is how little our culture at large understands the fallout of these kind of violations. To better understand some of the ways the brain and body can respond and what can be done to help, I talked with Linda Douglas, a trauma specialist for the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I asked Linda about one common response. Why do so many report freezing when all they really want to do is get away?
And that freezing piece sometimes gets interpreted as consent. And I think that's why so many conversations these days are around, let's have verbal consent, let's have enthusiastic consent is the word. For some people, that if they're questioning whether or not they should do something, have the conversation with the person before that person freezes.
Well, you've, in your experience, spoken with a lot of women who have been through sexual harassment and assault. And especially if it's something that happens in the workplace, they have to decide, often in isolation, I think,
yes,
whether or not to report it, especially if it feels ambiguous.
Yes.
Have you talked with them about how they process that?
Well, there's that sense of, did this really happen? Is this just me? And then the voice that they hear from is, oh, you can't take a joke. I didn't mean that. So I think for a lot of women, particularly in my generation, and I'm older, you can't see that on the radio, but I am, we have been taught to acquiesce, to take care of the man's feelings, So we sit back and we will tell ourselves, oh, it wasn't anything. Oh, he was just having a bad day. Someone once asked me, why does this woman I'm working with continue to choose men who abuse her? Mm-hmm. And I sat back and I thought, well, it's like we come into the world like a perfect hard-boiled egg. And we've got this wonderful shell on us. And the first bad thing that happens to us is like tap, tap, tap on the table, and that egg gets a crack in the shell. And then more things happen, and more cracks come in it, until we have someone who is an adolescent or a young adult, and a lot of that shell has been peeled away because people told them, you don't deserve to have a shell, you can't have a shell, that shell is getting in the way of my needs, and my needs are more important than your needs. So you have an adult now who is just this vulnerable egg, and then we'll say to somebody, well, you should have better boundaries. Well, the problem is those boundaries were told, she was told she shouldn't have those boundaries, and they were taken away from her.
We do know a lot more about how trauma affects the brain and how it affects memory. So how do those things play into reports about sexual assault?
Well, there's this belief that victims look a certain way, that you would be able to walk into an emergency room or into a police station and be able to immediately pick out the person who was the victim of a rape or sexual assault. And I've talked to some sexual assault advocates who say more often than you would believe, there's a lot of laughter happening in the emergency room when a rape kit is being done, because the body is trying to stop any pain, both emotional and physical. So it will release cortisol, oxytocin, and a number of other things. If we think of people in intense situations, we will often crack a joke or start to giggle at a funeral, and we're just wondering, why am I laughing at this? But it's just something that's happening as a stress response. The other thing is we expect people to be able to remember what happened quite vividly. The memories are all there in the brain, but sometimes what we don't understand is that victims, until they feel safe and stable, can't access those memories in a clear way.
Linda, I know we've been focusing on this as a very sort of hetero, you know, mm-hmm. kind of experience, that women harassed by men, which has been the primary driver of the Me Too mm-hmm. movement, but many LGBTQ people have yes. signed on to it, women in same-sex couples.
Transgender people.
Transgender yep. people. What should somebody do if they've been sexually harassed or assaulted?
They should call a local crisis center here in the state through the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic Violence. We have 13 crisis centers in the state. One of them is on the UNH campus, and the other ones are all throughout the state. We have accessibility to advocates 24 hours a day. You can talk to someone anonymously. You do not have to give your name. You don't have to be ready to report to the police. You can have someone there with you when you're at the emergency room. You can have someone with you when you're with the police. But you don't have to be ready to report. You just call up and you can just talk about it with somebody. And if you're not ready to do anything with it right then, that's fine. But I hope that you would call and then keep calling, and maybe someday you'll be ready. And if you're not, that's okay too. We can support you all along the way.
Over the past few months, women in high-profile, high-earning fields have been at the leading edge of exposing sexual predators. That behavior is not limited to Hollywood media and swanky restaurants, but happens across the socioeconomic strata. Women in domestic and service and other low-wage industries may be even more vulnerable. Karen was working at a pizza place while attending Keene State College when she was the target of workplace harassment.
Well, I was working in a pizza place as a college student, and there was one of the brothers took a shine to me, for lack of a better term. He would follow me into either the freezer or the refrigerator and proceed to hug on me and rub up against me and make comments And I never understood it because his wife was gorgeous. I didn't feel right about it. And at the time, I thought it was because he was married and hitting on me, and I thought that was inappropriate. But, you know, now I realize it's because I didn't want him near me. Any reason whatsoever didn't matter. I didn't want that attention. It made me feel uncomfortable. And there really wasn't anybody I could turn to. They didn't have an HR department. They were the boss. If it is the manager or the owner, there's really not much higher you can go. And the police aren't going to do anything for you. Where do you turn? You know, and they may not even see what they're doing as harassment because they don't think it's harassment and they think that everybody thinks like they do. Me, you know, massaging so-and-so's shoulders because she laughed it off was not sexual harassment. Well, she laughed it off because she was uncomfortable. I have a male friend who has done and said things that could be construed as sexual harassment, but then he turns around and is talking on Facebook about the Me Too movement and, you know, saying that he supports it and he does, you know, he's never done this, and I've had to correct him, been like, no, this that you said or this that you did could have been sexual harassment to the wrong person.
After the break, some other proactive responses to sexual harassment and assault in New Hampshire. We'll also get a male perspective on relating in the age of Me Too. That's coming up when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before we continue, a note that on today's show, we are talking about sexual assault and harassment in terms that may not be suitable for younger listeners or people sensitive to this topic. Your discretion is advised. We've heard from a number of women this hour, but to get a fuller picture of how the Granite State is responding to the Me Too movement, we reached out to someone who realized that he was part of the problem. This is Ryan Thompson, who lives in Nashua with his wife and young daughter. What did you think when you saw so many women you knew hashtag Me Too?
It was an incredibly positive thing, certainly, just that people feel comfortable enough to speak out.
So did you feel like you're a man? What could you say? Did you feel uncomfortable about that?
I didn't feel like I was currently part of the problem, but I felt like I certainly could have been in the past.
So what was it in your mind that you'd done wrong?
I don't know. It was more assuming that compared to what's permissible now versus what was permissible when I was 20 years ago, it's totally different. The context is different. The conversation is different.
I'm curious about what used to be permissible.
I think the best example is the Aziz Ansari case, where it's ignoring the first no, and it's literally wearing someone down, so they either just leave or give in to it. But either way, the bottom line is just not respecting a very explicit or at times implicit answer.
So that's something that, you know, maybe you were raised with this idea that's what you do. You just keep going.
Yeah. Growing up, you learn being, you know, like a guy from other guys, and none of those guys really know anything at all about what they're talking. But that's just a horrible misinformation loop.
So you decided to reach out to some of the women that you'd known in the past that you questioned your behavior with. So what made it sink in for you that it was time to do that?
The Aziz Ansari thing. At least for me, that's a far more recognizable kind of sexual violence, really, is what it would come down to.
So you could see yourself in that?
Yeah. I think it'd be disingenuous to say absolutely not. And that was very much why I had reached out. These were two women I've known them for a long time. I had dated both of them, and somehow, like years later, everybody's still friends. So I figured, if I'm going to try and get a better idea of who I was at a time, who's better to talk to than somebody that you can trust is going to be honest with you and not just tell you, no, you were swell, when in fact you're just a horrible person. So it was definitely some self-preservation. I definitely wanted to make sure I wasn't a terrible person. But, you know, asking the question, you have to be ready to be told you're a horrible person. You just kind of hope you're not told you're a horrible person.
So I think like a lot of women that I heard from in the Me Too movement, they said, well, I don't know, was I sexually harassed? They asked themselves that question. So it sounds like you were asking yourself the question, like, was I a harasser?
I think you have to. It's not a one-sided conversation. The problem is it's going to explode in a hashtag is what it comes down to. Nobody knows how to have the conversation. It's super uncomfortable, but you have to have it anyway.
So how did they respond?
It's surprisingly kind, which I was really, really glad to hear. It's not something you can judge on your own. I think you need an outside view.
But now that this conversation has started, mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think the role is for men going forward?
To shut up and listen. To listen, 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 and to stop that little flutter in your heart that you get when somebody starts to complain about men. Don't assume it's you. Maybe take that as a sign that, okay, and this is how my behaviors are affecting. Okay, let's work on that.
So if somebody were taking their own inventory and asking themselves, did I do that? Was I the aggressor? Have I harmed women? What would your advice be to them to reflect?
Every woman I know has to some extent been directly affected by sexual harassment and sexual violence, and there's no way that I'm the only one who wasn't, you know, in some way kind of complicit in any of it. But there's no way that I'm getting out scot-free. The math does not add up.
Changing a culture that has tolerated sexual harassment and assault requires conversations and action, like Ryan took. The University of New Hampshire's Prevention Innovations Research Center has been committed to ending sexual and relationship violence, specifically on college campuses, for more than a decade. Senior Celine Gedge works at the center. We talked to her about their work on bystander intervention and an app they designed to get students out of bad situations.
There are 6 boxes that you can choose. Time to leave, expect me, and angel drink are our safety features, and then need help now, helpful answers, and what now are our resources.
The app is called USAFE US, and it can tell users where and how to report sexual assault and direct you to the nearest hospital or police station. But it's a tool for prevention, too. On a date that's starting to feel uncomfortable, tap a few buttons, and it appears as if your roommate is sending you an urgent text.
So right now, the text says, hey, I'm in trouble. I locked myself out of my apartment again. I need you to come help me out.
Maybe a call from your dad or your best friend would seem more believable. USAFE can do that, too.
Hey, sweetie. Your mom's in the hospital.
Researchers have found that students want discreet ways to wiggle out of dangerous situations. And USAFE provides a selection of subtle outs, like the angel drink function, for example, which allows you to flag a bartender and tell them that you need help. While to any bystander, it would look like you're just showing them your drink order. USAFE was developed on New Hampshire campuses, but now the center is selling it to colleges and universities across the country. It's Celine's job to have conversations about safety and sexual assault and consent and social disparity. But those conversations aren't just happening in focus groups, but in dorm rooms and dining halls, but in online forums and among friends both on and off university campuses.
For me and my friends personally, it's such a pervasive reality that it's almost like every one of my friends have been in a situation where you could label that assault.
Celine resists cut and dry judgments of people who attempt or commit sexual assault and harassment. Not all aggressors are rapists or horrible people. To her, each individual and each act is symptomatic of something bigger happening, or more often not happening, in human interactions.
It's a lot harder for me to think of just like these random people insidiously like targeting people. I think that happens because the majority of rapes are perpetrated by a small group of people. But I think a lot of sexual interaction, like we haven't been taught how to talk about it and how to have those conversations and how to have enthusiastic consensual sex.
And when talking about consent, it is not the one standalone yes. One of the dialogues that's been missing is the ongoing conversation about consent while giving consent, or not giving it, for that matter.
I feel like the majority of people don't understand that consent is a process and that it can be revoked and that it takes constant communication, which doesn't have to be awkward or weird. Like, it can be sexy. Like, conversations about consent can be sexy. And, like, so it does get frustrating.
Many people look for that thrill and ambiguity and the things left unspoken in physical interaction. But to Celine, having clear conversations and enthusiastic consent does not mean giving up sexiness. It means giving up power.
I think that if we were having these conversations and taking accountability, that everybody would be having a lot more sex, a lot better sex. So I don't think it's about sex. I think it's about power. And I think people are really scared of giving up that power and that sense of entitlement.
This presumption of entitlement, Celine observes, probably starts at an early age. And by the time we get to college, it's really difficult to reverse it. Stopping the cycle of sexual violence and harassment, or even bumbling transgressions and discomfort. To do that, Celine says we have to nurture a different perspective and start much earlier.
If I was in charge, it would start in kindergarten, and not about sex at all, but about, you know, like, let's ask to hug people and stuff. And that seems so absurd to people, but like me desiring to hug somebody is never going to be more important than their desire to hug me back. So it's little things like that that I feel like would really change how we even think about these kinds of things, that we don't just make these assumptions.
In addition to her research, it's been helpful for Celine to talk with all of her friends about that moment that lands in the pit of your stomach. That moment when trauma perhaps could have been prevented, but one or both parties lack the vocabulary to stop it. It's in sharing those moments that she knows she's not alone, and that's helpful. The next step, she says, is for the person responsible for that discomfort or trauma to choose to do it differently next time, and to use their words. Before we leave this hour, we're going to hear from one more woman who shared her story with us. Allison was in high school the first time she was sexually assaulted. She's just turned 30 and only recently began talking publicly about that and two other assaults. Her way of sending a message to fellow survivors.
I did use the Me Too hashtag, and I am a multiple assault survivor. When I was assaulted at Plymouth State University, it was my first week of college. I think a lot of times we as women are told that our emotions don't matter, or anytime that we show emotion that we are hysterical, our emotions are invalidated consistently. I have most certainly given consent to a sexual partner when it was not something that I wanted to do. Because when I have said no in the past, I was not listened to. Not until very, very recently have I been public about my status as a survivor and have started to publicly speak out about it. One, it's up to the person and to the survivor to identify what happened to them. No one else can ever say, you know, this is what happened to you, or prescribe something to them. But there's a gray area, and that's a real thing. And I think that we as a country are just like, nope, it's very black and white. It's A to Z. That's it. And I think it's really important that we provide space for people to say, you know, I wasn't raped, but I definitely did not consent to this. And I think that it's really important for us as a society to sit in these conversations about this gray area, because sitting in your uncomfortability is vital. And that is where so much learning can happen. If I were to say anything to a fellow survivor, whether or not they disclosed to me that they had previously been assaulted, one of the things that I would want to say to them is, you know, first and foremost, I believe you and I trust you. I would want to say to any survivor, I'm holding you in the light, even though I know that it may feel like there's only darkness surrounding you. I would want to say to them, you know, invest in yourself. Unapologetically put yourself first in your healing process, no matter what that looks like. And that may change day to day, but just do it, because it will feel so freeing.
I am among the millions of people who use the MeToo hashtag. I was emboldened by all of those across the world who came out of the shadows, many puncturing through fear and shame that kept them there for years. I am grateful to them, and we are extremely grateful to the brave women who contributed their personal experiences for this episode. We shared only brief moments from our conversations with them. Their stories are complex and include many facets that we did not touch on in this episode. For that reason, we'll soon be making longer cuts of our conversations with Elaine, Faye, Karen, and Allison available. We'll let you know as soon as they're posted at wordofmouthradio.org. And special thanks today to Professor Linda Fowler at Dartmouth, Sharon Potter of UNH's Preventions Innovation Research Center, Lynn Shalit and Amanda Gray Sexton at the New Hampshire Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and Sheila McDonough. Today's episode was produced by Hannah McCarthy and me. Our production team includes Jimmy Gutierrez, Justine Paradise, and Taylor Quimby. Our executive producer is Erica Janik. Maureen McMurray is Shattering Glass Ceilings. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. We've posted links to some resources for people who are or have been sexually harassed or assaulted. There's lots of help available. Just go to wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up on Only in New Hampshire, we take the road less traveled. It makes all the difference. Stay with us.
Today, as part of our Only in New Hampshire series, we're digging into the Granite State's role in the life of a quintessentially New England poet. Listener Paul wrote in wanting to know more about Robert Frost and his New Hampshire haunts.
When I see birches bent to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain.
Though he came to typify the region, Frost was not born in New England. His first 11 years were spent in San Francisco. In fact, Frost didn't discover rural New Hampshire life until his short-lived attendance of Dartmouth College. But New Hampshire stuck. Though he would become Vermont's poet laureate and a Pulitzer Prize winner, a teacher at Middlebury College and a snowbird in Florida, the Granite State served as the backdrop for much of Frost's early work. For 11 years, Frost and his family lived on a small farm in Derry, New Hampshire. It was there that he found his poetic voice and discovered that he really wasn't much of a poultry farmer. May through October, you can tour the white clapboard house where Frost wrote many of the poems in A Boy's Will and North of Boston. You can attend readings, lectures, and a poetry conference in the summer. And year-round, the grounds are open to exploration. You can walk alongside Hyla Brook, wander the orchard, meet the subject of Frost's mending wall. After selling the farm in Derry, the Frosts left for Great Britain. It was there that Frost published his first volumes of poetry. The family returned to the U.S. when World War I began and settled on another New Hampshire farm, this one further north, in Franconia.
Well, he lived here full-time from 1915 to 1920, but after that came back every summer, and basically until his wife died.
This is Maudell Driscoll, executive director of what is now called the Frost Place, a museum and poetry center designed to reflect and honor Frost's legacy. And it comes with a decent view, too.
The road runs along a ridge, and you look from the windows of the house down into the Eastern Valley with the Franconia Range and with Mount Lafayette and Cannon. The fog comes in through that notch, and he called that the dragon entering. It's one of, you look out and the alpenglow sets on those mountains almost every day. It's just absolutely stunningly beautiful.
Driscoll says that it's difficult to know exactly which poems Frost wrote during his time in Franconia. What is known, though, is that in committing quintessential New England to the page, Frost had to bend rural tradition.
And people had a lot to say about Frost. Frost trained his cow to be milked at 12 and midnight, and he kept a different set of hours and different set of priorities than the people around here. And one of the things that he says is that, you know, you have to be sort of a bad farmer to be a good writer.
Though Frost would eventually leave Franconia and teach in Vermont, Michigan, and Massachusetts, his time at the farm left its mark. The town bought the small home in 1977 and established the Frost Place. From the get-go, it was intended to foster poetry in the community.
Having poetry and writing be at a remove is something that the Frost Place is not about in any way. And it's about it being accessible and open.
That accessibility extends to the Frost Place's poet-in-residence, who shares their quarters with the museum and presents readings of their work to the public.
Last year, when the poet came, one of the neighbors from down the road came up and brought a mason jar with flowers in it, welcomed them. The town welcomes them. They do a reading at the town library. And that first year, they left firewood on the porch and brought pies. I mean, they're really the town poet of Franconia. I can tell you that the poet in residence walks up that road to Franconia and has dinner at people's houses and reads at the museum and, you know, swims in the Ham Brook.
Working as Frost did is the privilege of the place. The requisite is a willingness to live like a true rural New Englander.
We get people who would be interested in Frost's legacy and be interested in rolling up their sleeves and being here. Because it's not like, you don't have like an air-conditioned studio when you come to the Frost Place. You know, we have bugs and we have, you know, and it's like it's hot or it's cold or it's, you know, this is not a climate-controlled environment. You know, there's not an espresso machine on every corner. There's spotty internet and spotty cell phone connections.
Most of the Frost Place's public programming begins in late May. But the grounds, as with the Frost Farm and Dairy, are open year-round.
You can come to the Frost Place right now, and we encourage people to come and sit on the porch and take in the trail. We've got Frost poems along the nature trail behind it. And you can come sit there and enjoy the sun going down if you want to.
You can learn more about the Robert Frost Farm and the Frost Place by going to wordofmouthradio.org or by stopping by, whether it's on a summer day or a snowy evening.
Stopping by woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness belt a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
For Word of Mouth's Only in New Hampshire, I'm Hannah McCarthy.